Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is the 19th episode. Wild Trekker is a series of podcasts, a writer's notebook, audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews with fascinating people, reflections, original radio plays, reportage, stories behind stories, jam sessions, and more. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. This is the second episode of a seven-part series I call Dream World. This week's podcast is devoted to writing about dreams. When you come right down to it, writing about dreams is one of the big themes of literature, from epic poems to novels, treatises on psychoanalysis, and even works about scientific discoveries. At the dawn of civilization, dreams were considered to be messages which gods sent to heroes, inspired, visionary messages revealing hidden knowledge which enabled heroes to battle with demons, defy death, unlock the secrets of existence, and found great cities. In the 19th century, archaeologists discovered cuneiform clay tablets in a royal library in Nineveh near Mosul in northern Iraq. They were covered with wedge-shaped symbols made with a stylus. It took a few decades to decipher them. These tablets included the oldest great work of literature, the Epic of Gilgamesh, which was written down in Akkadian around 1800 BC. This epic is based on myths about the king of Uruk, Gilgamesh, two-thirds god and one-third man. It appears Gilgamesh was a real person who reigned somewhere between 2800 and 2500 BC. Dreams are central to the poem. Gilgamesh befriends the wild man Enkidu, and they travel together to the realm of the gods, where there's a great cedar forest. There, the sun god Shamash sends Gilgamesh a series of oracular dreams. "The sleep that the god sent me is broken. Ah, my friend, what a dream I've had! Terror and confusion. I seized hold of a wild bull in the wilderness. It bellowed and beat up the dust till the whole sky was dark." Thank you. Enkidu says, "This dream is a sign Gilgamesh will be victorious in battle." Gilgamesh then says, "I dreamed again. We stood in a deep gorge of the mountain, and beside it, we too were like the smallest of swamp flies. And suddenly the mountain fell. It struck me and caught my feet from under me. Then came an intolerable light blazing out, and in it was one whose grace and beauty were greater than the beauty of the world." But then Enkidu himself has a dream. It came, an ominous dream. A cold shower passed over him. It caused him to cower like the mountain barley under a storm of rain. Then Gilgamesh has a third dream, and this dream was altogether frightful. The heavens roared, and the earth roared again. Daylight failed, and darkness fell. Lightnings flashed, fire blazed out, clouds lowered, they rained down death. Then the brightness departed, the fire went out, and all was turned to ashes fallen about us. How are these dreams to be interpreted? Enkidu says they mean Gilgamesh will soon defeat the guardian of the cedar forest, the mighty winged demon Humbaba, who has the face of a lion, thorny scales all over his body, and glares at people with the glare of death. These dreams, plus supernatural winds stirred up by Shamash, enable Gilgamesh to defeat Humbaba. Enkidu's dream, on the other hand, means he must travel to the dark underworld of the dead. This dream foreshadows his own death. The dreams in the Epic of Gilgamesh represent terror, confusion, and anxiety, but they also reveal hidden knowledge, predicting the outcomes of future battles and foreshadowing suffering and death. Mesopotamians from thousands of years ago believed that hidden knowledge transmitted in dreams was a gift of the gods. The fact these dreams appear in the poem shows just how important dreams were considered in the ancient Middle East. They're not just spontaneous stories one tells oneself while asleep. They are like symbolic portals to altered states of consciousness, where vital secrets fly in the heavens and lie deep below the ground. I find it amazing to consider that dreams, inscribed with a stylus on clay tablets, lay hidden for thousands of years and were only uncovered and deciphered over the last 150 years. Sigmund Freud published a fascinating work in 1900 called The Interpretation of Dreams. This work offers a comprehensive overview of his vision of the dream world. One of the pioneers of psychoanalysis, Freud sees the unconscious as the larger circle which includes the smaller circle of the conscious. Everything conscious has a preliminary unconscious stage, whereas the unconscious can stop at this stage and yet claim to be considered a full psychic function. The unconscious is the true psychic reality. In its inner nature, it is just as much unknown to us as the reality of the external world, and it is just as imperfectly communicated to us by the data of consciousness as is the external world by the reports of our sense organs. In the interpretation of dreams, Freud's own professional ambitions often intrude on the narrative. He wants to demonstrate his originality and improve his professional standing by deriving a scientific system about dreams from impressions, anecdotes, readings, and clinical observations. This means the patient before him converts vivid dream pictures into tentative word pictures on waking, which Freud then classifies and translates into logical deductive language. Freud then fits this language into a framework of doctrines, laws, and rules of the mind. This means that the raw content of dreams, or as much of that content as a patient is able to recall, is transformed during psychoanalysis into representational language, into decontextualized abstractions. Then, Freud seeks to recontextualize these abstractions by tracking down clues, newspaper articles the patient may have read recently, or books, or experiences the patient may recently have lived, etc. So we're already several times removed from the original intuitive dream pictures in the patient's mind. Some of Freud's associations strike me as forced. Some of his theories, particularly about hysteria and sexual perversions, have not stood the test of time. Yet Freud offers many insights, especially into his own personality. Between Gilgamesh and Freud, there's a whole range of hidden meanings to find in dreams. In ancient Sumer and Mesopotamia, the gods concealed knowledge from humans and only revealed it to them under the right circumstances. Dreams have been subject, over time, to an ever so gradual process of secularization. From being messages sent by gods to heroes, dreams became fantasies created in our sleeping minds by demons. Then they became spontaneous dream pictures, or stories we tell ourselves at an unconscious level. Psychoanalysis strives to create a scientific basis to understand these dreams rooted in the unconscious, but we're still faced with many unknowns. I would like to step back a moment to get a larger picture of the relationship between dreams, the imagination, and representation, because this will give a better idea where hidden knowledge comes from. First of all, a narrative, whether a dream, song, novel, or book of history, is a representation. You may object, but dreams are spontaneous narratives, whereas a song, novel, and book are deliberately constructed narratives. All right, but a dream is still a story we tell ourselves while asleep. A narrative tells a powerful, entertaining, meaningful story with language rich in symbols, myth, and metaphor. It does this by drawing on the emotional resources of the unconscious below the surface and giving them a unique voice. A narrative may present a protagonist or leading character, an antagonist or character seeking to thwart the protagonist, and other supporting characters. we have only to think of the protagonist, Gilgamesh, who battles the demon antagonist, Humbaba, and chops off his head. But narratives are not always so straightforward. Love in the Time of Cholera by Gabriel Garcia Marquez is an example of a work with no single protagonist. The central character changes from one part of the book to the next. It is nevertheless a character-driven story. A narrative contextualizes and clothes scenes and character development, whereas logico-deductive writing is based on abstractions, which are decontextualized, epitomized, and unclothed. When we remember a dream, we've passed, first of all, through the portal from the unconscious to the conscious mind. We then convert the dream from intuition into something more definite. We select elements that strike us as noteworthy, leaving out other elements that seem vague and hard to put into words. We use representational language to get a grip on the dream. Ancient Greek and Roman religion accorded great importance to dreams. In the 1st century AD, the Latin poet Ovid writes in Metamorphoses, "Near the Cimmerian country is a cave, deeply recessed, a hollow mountainside, the secret dwelling place of the languid gods Sleep, where the sun's rays can never reach, whether at his rising or at noon or at his setting. Dark mists are breathed out from the ground, and the half-light of evening's gloom." Around the god lie empty dreams, made to resemble different shapes, as many as the corn ears in the harvest, as leaves on the woodland trees, or sands scattered on the shore. The goddess Iris entered the cave and brushed aside with her hands the dreams that stood in her way. In this passage from Ovid, dreams have a real physical existence, a tangible presence. They lie scattered on the floor of Sleep's cave. They can be swept aside. Ovid also clearly associates dreams in this poem with the gods. I'm not sure Ovid really believes all the mythologies he writes about. A narrative may be linear, just as it may be non-linear. In the last podcast, I mentioned developing tactile metaphors for a blind student I had at the State University of New York. I handed him a ball of string, which made him think of a linear narrative. I handed him a sphere or plastic ball, which made him think of an idealized narrative. And then I handed him a sand rose from the Sahara Desert, which made him think of a complex or fractured narrative. These are just three examples of narrative structure, and I've explained them in metaphorical terms. Of course, a story needs narrative unity, which means that individual components need to be brought together into a coherent, well-crafted, and seamless whole. When we read a compelling narrative, we enter the world created for us by the author. Just what is this world? With each play, Shakespeare creates a microcosm in words, out of nothing. This little world is luminous, self-contained, and casts a spell over the spectators at the theater and even over the players. According to Stanislavski, actors actually experience their roles. Spectators and players believe in this little world, or they suspend their disbelief up till the very last words of the play. Thank you. A written narrative cannot simply be thrown together, like 52-card pickup, or pieces of shattered glass lying on the floor, or different anecdotes randomly strung together using the cut-and-paste method. It requires different styles of writing appropriate to the scenes, characters, and development of the plot. We have only to think of James Joyce's Ulysses, which includes dialogue, dreams, and even parodies of newspaper articles. Even so, the author needs to find his voice. As narrator, the creator of characters, and the evoker of scenes, finding one's voice is one of the biggest challenges in writing. A narrative should be coherent, well-crafted, and seamless. This means the author needs to draw on his intuition, experience, and craft to bring harmony and a sense of proportion to the colors in his palette. That is, the plot, characters, point of view, dramatic tensions, pacing, dialogue, and other language. The writing needs a sense of proportion to create a sense of harmony. We know about harmony from music. According to the great violinist Yehudi Menuhin, music creates order out of chaos, for rhythm imposes unanimity upon the divergent, melody imposes continuity upon the disjointed, and harmony imposes compatibility upon the incongruous. There are many dream scenes in Shakespeare. My favorite is the scene in Act 5 of Richard III, written about 1593, which has two rivals sleeping on the stage and sharing the same dream. Richard has a fearful nightmare in which he's haunted by the ghosts of people he has murdered. They predict he is doomed to die on the battlefield the following day. These same ghosts then visit Richard's rival Richmond in his dream, and predict he will be victorious the following day, and will be father to a new race of kings. We're presented once again with dreams as a form of hidden knowledge, but in this passage from Richard III, the dream is demonic rather than divine, and Shakespeare is on the way to secularizing the dream. A big question is, what does the dream narrative mean? If you think back to the Epic of Gilgamesh, the wild man Enkidu explains to his friend Gilgamesh that dreams have been sent by the sun god Shamash, foretelling his victory in battle. Shakespeare evokes a dream scene in which demons come variously to haunt the doomed king, Richard III, or foreshadow Richmond's victory on the battlefield. Freud, for his part, seeks to catalog and classify dreams, integrating them into what he considers a scientific framework of doctrines, laws, and rules. And this is where I part ways with Freud. I believe meaning itself is constantly on the move. It is fluid, like waves on the ocean. The author may have one deliberate meaning in a literary work by expressing or representing characters and scenes a certain way. The reader may find another meaning by interpreting these characters and scenes on the basis of personal experience or intuition or analogy by projecting order onto them. We may find meaning in a work by identifying with a certain character. For example, if we're reading Shakespeare's The Tempest, we may identify with Miranda or Ferdinand at a young age and Prospero at a later age. Meaning is not something fixed, like a received dogma. Meaning is rather something fluid, which may change from person to person based on point of view, but may also change in the mind of a single person at different times of his or her life. This is why we return to great works over and over again during the course of life, and they seem to reveal a new meaning to us each time. I can see 5 ways to interpret narratives, but these don't have to be mutually exclusive. These ways can also be used to interpret dreams. First, a literal reading, a word-for-word interpretation at a surface level, summarizing the story. Second, a symbolic reading, an interpretation, for example, of a novel in terms of representation, myth, and metaphor, exploring the unconscious emotions and motivations of the author and characters. This reading includes biographical and psychological analysis. Third, a thematic reading, an interpretation in terms of the overarching or central subject, that is, what the novel is about. For example, crime and punishment, a cholera epidemic, war and peace. This reading includes an exploration of the experiences and intellectual, ethical, cultural, and creative sources of the novel. Fourth, a textual reading, an interpretation in terms of the fabric of the novel, the connections between language, content, structure, and patterns. This includes interpreting the novel in line with the author's craft and intentions, and by drawing comparisons with other novels. And finally, a rhetorical reading, an interpretation in terms of the underlying message of the novel, the techniques of persuasion the author uses to inform, move by argument, and motivate the reader, and what the author does to drive this message home. This may include social and political analysis. Everything in a narrative, including the scenes, is told in relation to the characters. Otherwise, disproportionate descriptions, for example, of wilderness scenery, would qualify it as nature writing, and the appearance of characters against this backdrop of wild scenery would simply seem anecdotal. One novelist in particular strikes me as overly descriptive, and that is Henry James. The technique used in a narrative should be implicit rather than explicit, so there's no need for self-conscious pyrotechnics or grandstanding. The evidence the author uncovers supports the story, but a narrative is far more than just evidence. Creating means transforming. It also means starting with problems and looking for solutions. Critiquing means starting with the creator's solutions and looking for problems. An interpretation is a projection of order onto something else. The critic's interpretation may be insightful, may reveal patterns of which the author was unaware. I know because I've sometimes read reviews of my books that taught me a lot. But sometimes criticism bears simply no relation to the work in question at all. I mentioned a little while ago that Shakespeare set dreams on their way, from divine messages sent by the gods to demonic dreams sent by ghosts. This can be considered part of a process of secularization of the dream narrative. I find that the demons of Shakespeare's era are somehow like early drafts of the complexes and syndromes of psychoanalysis nowadays. In the mid-17th century, a few decades after Shakespeare's time, Robert Burton wrote The Anatomy of Melancholy, an extraordinary work. Sleep and waking, he writes, are common to all sensible creatures. Sleep is a rest or binding of the outward senses and of the common sense for the preservation of body and soul, For when the common sense resteth, the outward senses rest also. The fantasy alone is free, and is commander reason, as appears by those imaginary dreams which are of diverse kinds, natural, divine, demoniacal, etc. In another passage from this work, Burton explains what he means by demoniacal people. The last kind of madness or melancholy is that demoniacal obsession or possession of devils. Stupendous things are said of them. Their actions, gestures, contortions, fasting, prophesying, speaking languages they were never taught, etc. Many strange stories are related of them. By the late 19th century, dreams have become a color in the author's palette, like one of many instruments in a symphony orchestra. Fyodor Dostoevsky introduces dreams and dreamlike states into his narratives, which are fluid, shadowy psychological states. For example, in The Idiot, a novel from the late 1860s, Dostoevsky has the Prince Myshkin fidgeting with three letters in his pocket, letters somehow he doesn't dare read. These letters, too, were like a dream, Dostoevsky writes. Sometimes one dreams strange, impossible, and incredible dreams. On awakening, you remember them and are amazed at a strange fact. You remember, first of all, that your reason did not desert you throughout the dream. You remember even that you acted very cunningly and logically through all that long, long time, while you were surrounded by murderers who deceived you, hid their intentions, behaved amicably to you, while they had a weapon in readiness and were only waiting for some signal. You remember how cleverly you deceived them at last, hiding from them. Then you guessed that they'd seen through your deception and were only pretending not to know where you were hidden. But you were sly then and deceived them again. All this you remember clearly. But how was it that you could at the same time reconcile your reason to the obvious absurdities and impossibilities with which your dream was overflowing? One of the most compelling dream scenes in modern literature is in Rebecca, a Gothic novel from 1938 by Daphne du Maurier, which Alfred Hitchcock later turned into a film starring Laurence Olivier and Joan Fontaine. The opening words of this remarkable novel are as follows. Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. It seemed to me I stood by the iron gate leading to the drive, and for a while I could not enter, for the way was barred to me. There was a padlock and a chain upon the gate. I called in my dream to the lodge-keeper, and had no answer, and peering closer through the rusted spokes of the gate, I saw that the lodge was uninhabited. No smoke came from the chimney, and the little lattice windows gaped forlorn. Then, like all dreamers, I was possessed of a sudden with supernatural powers, and passed like a spirit through the barrier before me. These opening lines of Rebecca set the tone for the entire novel. They create a supernatural atmosphere, the gate itself being like a portal to a world of hidden knowledge. Dreams are not only found in works of literature. Visionary dreams have had a significant impact on the formation of new philosophical, mathematical, and scientific theories. Examples are a dream which led to René Descartes' theory of dualism in the 17th century, and another dream which helped him reconcile Euclidean geometry with algebra. Descartes was a driven man who wanted to make his imprint on the natural philosophy of his age. That he should have a three-part dream in November 1619 of discovering the foundations of a wonderful science suggests that this personal drive operated on an unconscious level. His early 17th century biographer Adrien Bayet described the three dreams in detail. It's interesting to note that Descartes was greatly disturbed by the first two dreams, which he interpreted as threatening admonitions of terror and dismay. But he took consolation in the third dream, which he saw as an indication of the future path of his life. He vowed the very next day to make a pilgrimage to Loreto to enlist the favor of the Blessed Mother of God. There's some irony in the fact that this avowed rationalist should use these vivid but involuntary dreams to build up a personal mythology, placing the dreams at the center of a bold life mission, which in itself was purportedly to establish true knowledge of the rational order throughout the universe. In the 19th century, the chemist Dmitri Mendeleev discovered the periodic table of elements on the basis of a dream. Mendeleev said that in the 1860s, I saw in a dream a table where all elements fell into place as required. Awakening, I immediately wrote it down on a piece of paper. Only in one place did a correction later seem necessary. The chemist Auguste Kekulé made a similar claim in the 1860s about his discovery of the structure of the benzene molecule. Kekulé had been attempting for some time to solve the structural riddle of the benzene molecule, writes Robert L. van der Kassel in Our Dreaming Mind. He fell asleep in a chair and began to dream of atoms flitting before his eyes, forming various structures and patterns. Eventually, some long rows of atoms formed and began to twist in a snake-like fashion. Suddenly, one of the snakes seized hold of its own tail and began to whirl in a circle. So, on the basis of the intuitions arising during this dream, Kekulé developed a model of a closed ring with an atom of carbon and hydrogen at each point of a hexagon, and thus ascertained how the benzene molecule was structured. Another example of a visionary dream helping to resolve a complex scientific problem is provided by Albert Einstein. In Creativity, the Magic Synthesis, Silvano Arieti describes how Einstein's fantasies in the early years of the 20th century helped him to discover the theory of relativity. Einstein visualized himself as a passenger who rode on a ray of light and held a mirror in front of him. Since the light and the mirror were traveling at the same velocity in the same direction, and since the mirror was a little ahead, the light could never catch up to the mirror and reflect any image. It is fair to say a non-scientist, an uninitiated person, who had never spent years investigating such theoretical problems, could never have solved the benzene riddle. But it is worth noting that dreams, the unconscious, and metaphors have played a significant role in modern science. This is in no way a reflection on the validity of scientific discoveries. Beyond the overt rationality of scientific thinking, many of the same deep-set attitudes, motivations, and concerns have survived from the era of Gilgamesh, thousands of years ago. Einstein wrote to his friend Janos Plesch, When I examine myself and my methods of thought, I come to the conclusion that the gift of fantasy has meant more to me than my talent of absorbing knowledge. According to the 20th century philosopher Ernst Cassirer, the great thinkers who have defined man as a rational animal were not empiricists, nor did they ever intend to give an empirical account of human nature. By this definition, they were expressing rather a fundamental moral imperative. Reason is a very inadequate term with which to comprehend the forms of man's cultural life in all their richness and variety. But all these forms are symbolic forms. Hence, instead of defining man as a rational animal, we should define him as a symbolic animal. The dream, like other narratives, is a form of representation, a fluid series of dream pictures, rich in symbols and emotional content. This is true of dreams in the Epic of Gilgamesh, just as it is true of dreams experienced by Descartes, Mendeleev, and Einstein, over a nearly 4,000-year period. Literature describing dreams provides us with language that is inspired, visionary, promising, sublime, enchanting, and frankly astonishing. A dream narrative appeals above all to the visual imagination by evoking rather than describing. Evoking is further along the path of creativity than describing. Leonardo da Vinci writes, "Painting is poetry that is seen rather than felt, and poetry is painting that is felt rather than seen." For me, poetry is a form of narrative and imaginative writing, exploding like bursts of energy or bolts of lightning. Dreams reveal to us portals leading to another world below the surface, a world full of symbols and emotion. Well, that's it for this week's podcast. I'm going to return next week with part 3 of this 7-part series I call Dream World. If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, translations, films, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net. And Evidencia is spelt E-V-I-D-E-N as in normal, T-I-A. I don't know why I keep saying N as in normal, honestly. The opening theme at the beginning of each Wild Trekker podcast is sung by Marie Frenette, with me accompanying her on the piano. Now here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker, accompanied by Pascal Desmeules on the guitar. Let's get together soon. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2020, George Toombs. All rights reserved.